underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Charles Duhigg's first book, The Power of Habit, has spent over 150 weeks on the New York Times bestseller lists. In his new book, Smarter, Faster, Better, The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business, he applies the same curiosity, deep reporting, and storytelling to explain why some people and companies are able to get so much more done than others. Charles Duhigg is an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and we welcome Charles Duhigg to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. A delight
to
have you here.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Let's start with The Power of Habit, which has taken on a life of its own. So what do you think has struck such a chord with people, and have you achieved your mission with that book?
Well, I don't know if I've achieved my mission, but I like the question. I think that in many ways, we live during this amazing time, right? We're living kind of through a technological revolution and an economic revolution. But I think for a lot of people, and I include myself in this, there are these things that seem frustrating about what's supposed to be this utopia that we're living through, right? It's frustrating to me that as someone who is hopefully smart and accomplished, that when I was writing The Power of Habit, that I couldn't stop myself from eating my kids' chicken nuggets during dinner, like without even thinking about it, I'd pop them into my mouth. And it was like, why can't I control this behavior? And similarly with Smarter, Faster, Better, it's the same thing where it's like, if I'm surrounded by all these amazing devices, if we're in the age where we're just a step away from self-driving cars, why do I feel like I'm running so hard and falling farther and farther behind? Why isn't it that I get to like kick up my heels at 3:30 in the afternoon and let the robots take over for me? And I think trying to answer those questions is hard, but equally, because of the time we're living through this golden age of understanding neurology and the age of big data, which lets us understand how people behave. And we can actually tell people, here's how you change your habits, or here's how you become more productive in the ways you want to be.
We are so often conditioned that we as a species are not very pliable, that it is difficult for us to change. It's difficult for us to change what is culturally innate, as well as you indicated in your first book, the habits that we have. You believe we're more pliable than that.
I think we are. And I think that there's a lot of evidence around us of how pliable we are. Just to use like my own life as an example, my great aunt, my father was born during the Great Depression, and his aunt was a hunchback because she had suffered from rickets as a child because of malnutrition. That just doesn't really happen in America anymore, right? Like, just think in less than 100 years, think about how much our daily lives have changed. Now, I grew up in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, and I now live in New York City. My life is completely different from my parents' lives. My life is different from my older cousins' lives. We change so much throughout our life. And the thing is that you're right. There is this cultural bias that causes us to focus on what is hard to change. But that ignores how frequently people actually do transform their lives throughout their lives. And drawing attention to that is actually one of the big insights of psychology and neurology nowadays, is saying our brains are much more plastic than we think they are. Really, the act of making choices can change fundamentally how you see things and how you behave. We see it happen all the time.
You went out and you studied productive companies and productive people. My question is, in most cases, were those traits, those commonalities that you found that were successful, were those from the ground floor and intuitive for those particular individuals and companies, or were they learned over time?
They were absolutely learned over time. They weren't intuitive at all. And this is, I think, the big takeaway, is that the people who are most productive, they're not the most productive because they like went to a great school or their parents were rich or they work for Google. In fact, they weren't productive because they just knew how to be productive. They were productive because they learned something about their life, about themselves, and most importantly, because they built some structures within their lives that allowed them to kind of reflect on what's going on and learn from it and change as a result.
So the commonalities and the concepts that you kept coming up with, you ultimately identified 8.
That's right.
So let's go down the list and talk about what you found, and then we can go and sort of take them off one by one. So the 8 traits you found were...
So it, we'll start at the top. Sometimes hard to remember all of them. But
I've got them here if
there's,
you need
them. There's self-motivation, right?
Yes.
So one of the things we learned is that the most productive people, they tend to envision chores as choices that make them feel like they're in control. The second one, oftentimes, is how teams function. The most productive people know how to work in teams. And they know that teams function not because they have all the smart people together, but because they interact in smart ways. Most importantly, they have this thing called psychological safety. The third one is focus, that the most productive people, they know how to sharpen their focus by creating what psychologists refer to as mental models, telling themselves stories about what's going on as it occurs. The fourth one is goals. The most productive people, they tend to set goals in these ways that remind them of their biggest, most important ambitions, instead of getting lost in the weeds. And then we get to things like managing others, that oftentimes success is dependent on how well you can motivate others, how well you can manage others. And there's all these things like lean management and agile management that tell us put decision making with the person closest to the problem. There's decision making, which engages with probabilistic thinking. There's innovation, which tells us that the way that we figure out something clever and new isn't necessarily by being super creative ourselves. It's by finding a process that encourages us to take old ideas and look at them in new ways. And finally, the most productive people, they're really good at looking at data. But paradoxically, the way that they look at data is they slow it down. They make it what's known as disfluent, so that instead of having all these graphs and numbers whizzing by your head, you actually force yourself to do something with it. And that makes it real.
Back to a statement that you said at the beginning of our conversation, which is that you had hoped at some point that we could, by 3:30, we could take off our shoes and let the robots take over. Is that what we ultimately want?
I don't think so. I think the goal is to be able to identify which goals are most important to each person and to do it without all this stress and strife, right? That feeling of getting home at 6 o'clock at night and all you want to do is have dinner with your kids and then maybe like have a glass of wine with your spouse and watch TV, but you've got like 30 emails hanging over your head, that's a terrible feeling. And that is a feeling that can be removed if you understand how your brain works.
Charles Duhigg is our guest. The name of the new book is Smarter, Faster, Better. It is published by Random House, the subtitle, The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business. So you begin with motivation, and that motivation, I assume, is most often a personal motivation, but then can also be a corporate motivation.
Actually, personal motivation is really where I focus, because what I'm really looking for is how do the best people learn to self-motivate? And it turns out that there's a lot of science about this. In fact, we tell this story through the Marine Corps, because about 15 years ago, the Marine Corps had this big problem, which is a ton of their recruits coming in had no idea how to self-motivate. Now, we think of basic training as this thing that teaches you like to follow orders, right? But that's not what the Marine Corps basic training does nowadays. What it does nowadays is it teaches people to generate what's known as an internal locus of control, to look for choices that they can make that prove to them that they are in charge and they are doing meaningful things. Because if you can learn to turn a chore into a choice and you can link it to something that matters to you, you can generate neurologically self-motivation much, much more easily. And that's what the most productive people do.
So assuming we are working for somebody and we are the employee, not the employer, the chore is the project they want us to work on. We come up with the choice.
That's exactly right. And so one of my favorite examples is I was talking to this professor. He was a cancer researcher. And he said to me, look, I hate grading papers, right? My university tells me I have to grade papers all the time.
Yeah.
So this is what I do. I sit down and first of all, I decide where I'm going to start. Am I going to start with like the third essay? Am I going to start with the fifth question? I prove that I'm in control. But then I think to myself, if I grade these papers, it helps the university earn tuition dollars. And if it earns tuition dollars, it can pay for my research. And my research is going to save people's lives. So by grading these papers, I am saving people's lives. Now, no PhD should have to go through that mental gymnastics, right, to just grade papers. But here's the interesting thing is that we know that our brain, particularly the older parts of our brain, a part known as the striatum and the basal ganglia, they sort of function almost by reaction. when we force ourselves to think about that, why am I doing this thing? Ask ourselves questions. Why am I doing this chore? Does it link up to some value or some objective that's really meaningful to me? That neurologically, that actually triggers these old parts of our brains and it makes it easier to start. We've all had that experience, right? Where like there's something you don't want to do and you're dreading it. And then someone says like, look, if you do this thing, it's going to help me so much, or it's going to make the world better, or it's going to get you closer to that goal. And suddenly it's like someone flips a switch. That's our neurology. Our brain is designed to do that. But sometimes we have to flip the switch ourselves. We have to prime the pump.
You write about teams, and I have to say that if I were not a responsible book show host, I would just really want to talk to you about Saturday Night Live for about a half hour. But okay, we have other things to talk about. However, I found it fascinating that you chose that organization, that show, that very successful show. Being a devotee of that program and having been around since its inception, it strikes me that it has not always been the most functional lot, that there was a lot of dysfunction going on. But what you ultimately found out is they kind of got their act together.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating story about Saturday Night Live. So if you told me that you're going to take a bunch of egomaniacal comedians and put them in a room and then they have a week to do a live show over and over again.
What could go wrong?
I would tell you that's the worst idea I've ever heard. Yeah. But it's been on the air for 40 years, right? And so when I asked people from the original seasons why, they said, oh, Lorne Michaels. Lorne Michaels has this crazy way of managing teams where if you're at a table with him, if you haven't spoken up in the last 5 or 6 minutes, he'll basically force you to start talking. And he's like eagle-eyed looking for people who look upset or disengaged or really enthusiastic. And as soon as you express some emotion non-verbally, he'll stop everything and he'll say, hey, Jim, it looks like you're really, really excited about this idea. Why don't you tell us why? Or you know, hey, Marty, it looks like you're not really that into what's going on. Your arms are crossed. Tell us what you're thinking. What he's doing is he's creating this thing called psychological safety. And studies show that if a team has psychological safety, if everyone is speaking up, and if everyone is attuned to looking for nonverbal cues from each other, the team like becomes much more effective, right? You can take this like crazy egomaniacal comedian and you can get them to say things, to disagree with each other, but still feel like everyone at the table supports them, has their back. And that's what it takes to make a great show.
And that comes in a very competitive environment as well, right? I mean, because they, all the writers, the performers, they're all fighting for that 90 minutes of airtime.
That's exactly right. And in fact, Google did this big study. We had this excerpt in the Times Magazine from the book. Google did this big study where they looked at their best teams for 4 years with spending millions of dollars. And they found the exact same thing, that even in a competitive environment, you need to figure out some communication system, some culture on that team where everyone believes, oh, I can compete. I can challenge you. I can listen to you challenge me, but I'm not going to hold it against you. I'm not going to feel like I'm being alienated. Instead, I know that no matter what happens, I can come back to the table and say my piece and that you're going to listen to me, because if I look clearly pissed off, you're going to say, hey, what's the matter? Let's take a second to talk it out. Once you have that culture, that's when even your B team players create an A team.
You write about focus, you write about goal setting. These two very much hand in hand with one another.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that we know about goals is having the right goals and expressing them the right way lets you maintain your focus. So one of my favorite examples of this is to-do lists, right? Everyone writes to-do lists.
Yes.
This is how I used to write to-do lists before I started writing this book. I would put like at the bottom, like all these lofty goals, like write a book, run a marathon, lose 30 pounds. And then at the top of the list, I'd put things like go to the ATM, you know, pick up some new pens at the store. And it felt so good to sit down at my desk and like do those easy things first and cross them off.
Sure.
Right? It feels great. When I talked to psychologists, they said, oh, no. You're using a to-do list for mood repair. You're not using it for productivity. The way that you write a to-do list to actually help you keep your focus on the right goals is you have to put those hard things at the top of the list. Put your biggest ambitions at the top of the page to remind you of what you're moving towards. But then the problem with a big ambition is it's too overwhelming. So under that, they said you need a system to break it into a plan. And they recommend using, for instance, SMART goals. There's lots of different systems, but one of them is SMART goals, where I say, okay, what do I want to get done today? Let's choose a sub goal. And I say, specifically, what is my goal? How am I going to measure it? Is it achievable? Is it realistic? What's my timeline? They call it SMART goals because that spells smart. It's easy to remember. Mm-hmm. But the point is, it takes about 45 seconds to just ask those questions and jot down what my sub goal is and specifically what I want to get done in the timeline. And then I have a plan to start. And then when I'm done, when I got like one thing checked off, instead of patting myself on the back and feeling great and going down a Facebook time warp for the next 45 minutes, I'm reminded of my bigger goal because it's right there at the top of my page. I'm reminding myself what my top priority is. And your brain becomes more attuned to staying focused on the right things that way.
You don't get either deflated by the fact that I didn't hit that. I did get this done, but I didn't get that done. And still that reminder, not so subtle reminder, that there is something that you didn't get done.
That's exactly right. A to-do list should be a system to prioritize, and it should add a little bit of tension into your day where it says, here's the thing that you want to do, your biggest aspiration. Here's what you want to stay on track for, but here's the plan to get to that place. Here's the next step to take. And the idea here is that the to-do list becomes what's known as a contemplation device, right? We right now are inundated with information and with tasks, right, and with our phone buzzing and email. The most successful people, they build contemplation devices, something that just forces them to take a couple of minutes and say, am I actually going after the right goal today? Do I have a plan in place that's keeping me on track? Am I focusing the right way because I've expected what's going to happen at this meeting? Have I thought through what's going to happen? This isn't a big time commitment, but these contemplation devices, which are things like to-do lists or building mental models or remembering to get everyone at your team to speak up, those are things that cause us to just take a little break and ask ourselves, am I being as productive as I can be, or am I simply reacting to all the noise around me?
That idea of having to remember to have team members speak up and that kind of thing, you write, one of these, of course, is managing others. There's what we have to do, and then we also have to keep our eyes on the people that we are managing. And that can be a delicate balance.
Absolutely. It's a really tough balance. Our reaction, our knee-jerk, is usually to say, I'm just going to take control, right? Like, I'm going to tell this guy what to do, or I'm going to tell this woman, you should do it that way. We think of management as actually managing, taking control. But it turns out that most of the science shows, the best managers, they do the opposite. They empower the people underneath them.
You use the word trust much more than you use the word leadership.
That's exactly right. Because one of the things we know, and in the book we tell this through the story of an FBI and this big kidnapping investigation. The FBI has reformed everything that they do so that managers tell field agents, I trust you to follow your instincts. If the person closest to the problem has the responsibility for solving it, all of a sudden they become an expert in what ought to be done. And that's really what the best managers do. The best managers empower the people beneath them, or they empower their colleagues, because they know that if you're a field agent and you see all these clues about a kidnapping victim, your brain is going to be better than anyone else's at figuring out, no, that clue, it's bugging me. We got to follow that one. And you're going to be able to rescue the person. Not if someone back in Washington, D.C. is telling you what to do. That's when you lose the expertise that every single person carries around inside their head.
What do poker playing and decision making have in common?
So in the book, we tell the story of this woman named Annie Duke, who's a fascinating woman. She was in a PhD program studying cognitive science. She drops out of the program because she's too anxiety, like she's just overcome with anxiety. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know what to do with her life. And she finds that she kind of gets calmest when she's playing poker professionally. So she becomes this professional poker player. And she ends up being one of the best poker players in the world. What she realizes is the key to being a great poker player is being able to imagine multiple futures and not looking for certainty, but looking for what is certain and what's uncertain and being okay with that. So most of us, when we think about the future, we think of at most about like two possibilities, right? I'll get married or I won't get married. And what happens there? But people who are really good decision makers, they try and envision as many possibilities as they can. I get married and we have kids. I get married and we don't have kids. I don't get married, but we end up getting married later. I don't get married, but I find someone else, right? They try and figure out like, what are all the possible futures that I'm standing in front of? And somehow when we start doing that, our brain becomes much more sensitive to figuring out which of those futures is most likely to come true and why. And that actually helps people make better decisions. The trick, though, is that in order to build that intuition, in order to be able to like make a good choice and judge those possibilities, you have to expose yourself to both failures and successes. Most of us spend our time looking at successes instead of failures. We ask our friends why they got married, but we don't ask them why they got divorced. But to inform our intuition, we need to ask both kinds of questions.
You write about innovation, and to do so, you tell the story behind Disney's Frozen, which is one of the highest grossing films ever. And what I didn't realize in the fascinating backstory is the creative pressures. It was really a gun to the head that kind of brought all this together.
Absolutely. Frozen was on the brink of catastrophe until literally months before it was in the theaters. And what happened was that catastrophe, that pressure, that creative tension, that was actually a great thing. Because instead of trying to come up with some whole new idea and reinventing everything about cartoons, which is what the team initially thought they were going to do, they got so panicked that they said, look, we got to go back to basics. What does Disney know? Disney knows princess stories. We know them really well, right? But that's not enough on its own. What else do we know? An unusually large number of women working on Frozen. It was actually the first female director in Disney's history was one of the directors on Frozen. And so as they're sitting around and they're saying, we got to come up with some idea for this movie. You know, time's running out. One of them says, well, look, you know, the other thing we know is we know sisters. Right, we know sisters, like the relationships are complicated between sisters. It's usually not like one is good and one is evil. It's like both are kind of messed up and they need to help each other. So what if we took these ideas, princesses and sisters, what if we mash them together and that's Frozen?
Finally, it's absorbing data. And sometimes when we think of this just as an idea, we already, you know, the eyes gloss over and we think, oh, okay, we got enough to keep track of. So my question for you is, if we accept the premise, we have to absorb the data, what are we looking for?
So what we're looking for is we're looking for ways to make that data mean something. There was this fascinating experiment where they took a whole bunch of students and they had them all listen to the same lecture. And half of them were told to take notes by hand and half were told to type notes into a laptop. Now, typing is much more efficient than taking notes by hand. You collect a lot more information, a lot more data. But then they would take all the notes away, and a week later they'd ask everyone to come back, and they'd test them on what they'd heard. The handwriters outscored the typists every single time. And the reason why is because when you make information a little bit paradoxically harder to absorb, when you have to do something with it, that's when you really learn from it. And for all of us, it means that like all these apps we have on our phone, right? I have this app that connects to my scale wirelessly. And so I weigh myself every day and then it sends me like a pretty graph of how much weight I've lost in the last week. And I thought, oh, this is great. I'm going to lose weight. I have all this data. And it didn't change anything because I would just look at the graph and my eye would think, oh, what a pretty graph. And then I'd put it away. Right. So then what I started doing is every Sunday night I would sit down and on a piece of paper, I would look at that graph and I would draw the graph myself by hand on a piece of paper. And then I would think like, oh, Wednesday, like my weight went up a couple pounds. And like, that's also the day I didn't go running and I didn't have that much willpower at lunch. So I ate a hamburger. It's when I started using it by hand, when I made it paradoxically less easy to absorb, right? Because I made myself do something with the data, with the numbers. Mm. That's when I started learning from it. And the same thing is true of kids in schools. If you want a kid to actually learn something, don't just give them some fancy app that throws a bunch of like data points at them. Instead, make them sit down and write onto flashcards what they're trying to learn. Interacting with information is what causes it to stick in our head, not making it slicker or easier to put onto some digital device.
So you believe it is possible to be smarter and faster and better and still be psychologically calmer people.
What's most important is to decide when it's appropriate to be smarter and when it's appropriate to be faster and when it's appropriate to be better. There's sometimes that being smarter means slowing down a little bit. There's sometimes that, like when replying to emails, that getting faster means being okay with your emails not being these like perfectly worded pieces of prose. There's sometimes when being better doesn't matter quite as much as everything else because just getting it done is what's important. The point is that the people who have the ability to force themselves, some device, the people who force themselves to think just a little bit more, they're the ones who get to decide, what does smarter, faster, or better mean? Which one's important to me right now? And as a result, they only have 24 hours in the day just like us, but they get the things done that they really want to get done, and they're more relaxed about it.
The name of the book is Smarter, Faster, Better, The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and business. Charles Duhigg, always a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Charles Duhigg's new book is Smarter, Faster, Better. It is published by Random House. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.